thought there was going to be another hymn, but then I guess I'm getting, like Mr. Pacelli said, slower than molasses. Oh, I think the molasses is passing me up. Mr. McLean's brief comments about what's coming up in 10 days, I've got to tell you my favorite political joke, which maybe I've told you before or maybe not. But a certain congressman was having a question and answer session with some reporters and just wasn't giving any kind of direct answer. You always know they're not going to give you an answer when they say, that's a great question, which means right away they're not going to answer it. And so the reporters were getting fed up, and finally one reporter said, Congressman, I'm going to ask you a question where you can give us a simple, straightforward answer just so you can get something on the books that you actually did answer. What's your favorite color? Congressman said, plaid. I don't think that's true, but it very well could be. I want to thank everyone that sent feast cards to me and other nice things, and certainly appreciate that. In my length in the church, I was able to attend the 54 feasts, but someone told me something that was actually encouraging about not being able to go to the feast. A person said, we're all eventually going to get too old to go to the feast. And I believe that's true for the most part. Well, my message today has to do with a couple of words, insight and impact. Insight and input. Insight and input. And I always like to define things before we're going to start discussing them. Insight's defined as the power or act of seeing or understanding a situation, the act of understanding the inner nature of things. Insight. The inner nature of things. A college professor once made a statement that really made an impact on me, and I've always remembered it. He said, there's so many people who go through life and never gain insight into themselves. Never gain insight into themselves. The other word is input. Something that is put in us and taken as advice or as an opinion or as instruction. Something that helps in making a decision. Now, insight and input are important to all of us. Important to all of us. It's difficult sometimes to gain insight into ourselves and to gain insight into how God works with us and how we do or don't work with Him. Proper input is one side of the coin, and the other side of the coin is improper input. Question, does God take and accept input from us? Why does He accept input sometimes and sometimes He may not? I'll give you a little example, you know, of a dad who's using some tools and hammering some things, and the little boy says, Dad, I can hammer a nail. Can I take that hammer and hammer a nail? And Dad said, yes. And he's going to give him some input. But be careful. And about a minute later, he hears a big ouch. He said, what happened, son? Well, I hit myself with a hammer. So he heard Dad's input, and giving him some type of insight into the danger, but the child didn't really pay heed to it. You know, there's a type of nail that carpenters don't like to hit. It's called a thumbnail. And we've probably all experienced that at some point in time. Someone gives us a little advice, we think we know better, and we hit ourselves on our thumb. So gaining insight into ourselves and taking input from God is what our lives are all about. That's why we're living on this planet, and I'm going to repeat that. Gaining insight into ourselves and God is what our lives are all about and why we're living on this planet. We have to gain insight into ourselves and insight into God and how He deals with us. Does God take input from us, we as human beings? And do we give proper input into God. So we're going to look at some examples today in the scriptures and examine some of the truths that God expects us to learn and internalize about this whole subject of insight and input. So if you will, turn to Judges, the sixth chapter. Judges, the sixth chapter, and we're going to look at an interchange between God and Gideon. And I won't go into detail about all this, but we're going to look at these things, these scriptures today, maybe in a little different light or from a little different point of emphasis. So it seems that the Midianites and the Amalekites were gathering up. They were going to attack Israel, and the Lord came upon Gideon. The Spirit of the Lord did, and they had a little interchange here. And God gave Gideon a job. He said, you've got a responsibility here. I'm going to give you a job. I'm going to give you some input, and I want you to follow it. Gideon was a little unsure and uncertain. And we see starting here in verse 36, Gideon said to God, well, if you're going to save Israel, and I'll interject this by my hand, or if you're going to rely on me to do it, as you have said. And then Gideon says, I've got a request to make. I've got something for you to consider, God. Look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor, and if there is dew on the fleece only, and it's dry on all around the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. So, a little interaction here between God and between Gideon. Verse 38, and it was so, when he rose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece and a bowl of water. But that wasn't good enough for Gideon. Wasn't good enough for him. So then Gideon said to God, but he was very cautious and very polite. He said to God, well, now don't be angry with me, God. But let me speak. Just hear me out here. Let me test. I pray just once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, but all on the ground let it be dew. Now, what God didn't say and didn't do in the way of impact is this. Gideon, I've had enough. I did what you asked me to do. I am God. We're having this discussion. And I'm not going to play around and play a lot of games here. I've got something important for you to do. Get to work. Do the job. But God didn't do that, did he? God didn't do that. And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on the ground. So God took Gideon's input. Why did he take his input? Because Gideon approached him with the right attitude. He said right off, I don't want you to get mad at me, God. But I got to have more reassurance. And God honored that. God honored that. He honored Gideon's polite asking and concern, and he obeyed God, and the outcome of it all was that God did what he said he would do and deliver the Midianites into the hands of Israel. So that's one thing we can sort of put a mental little note up here. It's how we approach God, how we react, how we gain insight into God, and how we can approach him so that he will give us all positive input. Next example is Cain and Abel. Cain and Abel. Let's go to Genesis 4. Look at this again, as I said, in a little different light. And then go in a little more detail on all this later. Genesis 4, and we all know the story about Cain and Abel. Starts out, you know, Adam knew Eve and his wife, and she conceived, and she bore Cain, and she bore, happened again, and she bore Abel, so they're these two sons. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground of the Lord. So he was a crop farmer, brought his offering to God. And Abel also brought the firstlings of his flock and their fat, and the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And what was Cain's reaction? He was angry, and his countenance fell. And so we look at this and we think about it. What is the difference between these two attitudes? Well, one attitude was, did the best job. He brought the firstlings of his flock. He obeyed God and he respected God, but Abel had no unkind interaction with God in any respect. But Cain was a whole different matter, wasn't he? Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. In other words, he was felt like God had really mistreated him. He just wasn't treating him right. He was not giving him good input. You know, Cain probably said to God, we have to read between the lines here a little bit, look, God, there's your offering. I did what you asked me. And I hope you're happy because I had to take time out from doing some other work to gather all this stuff up. Probably didn't gather up the best quality representation of his offering because God didn't have any respect for it. His attitude towards God was one of no humbleness, self-willed, cocky, jealousy, angry, and not respectful of God at all. Whereas Abel, and it's interesting, we don't see any direct quotes here from Abel, but we just know from what we have read, Abel was the opposite. Cain paid lip service to God. He could make the case, you know, in his eyesight, I did what you told me, God. What do you want? What more do you want? So that type of approach didn't go very far with God. He didn't respect it. Then notice, though, that God didn't, there's no record here of God coming down with a lightning bolt or thundering at Cain. He just said, probably in a quiet but firm voice in verse 6, so the Lord said to Cain, why are you upset? Why is your countenance fallen? Why are you feeling so mistreated here? Verse 7, God says, if you do well, you do what I ask of you. If you do well, will not you be accepted? And, you know, all I'm asking you is to bring this offering and do it in a certain good attitude. It's going to be okay. But God says, if you don't, well, sin lies at the door and its desire is for you. For you should rule over it. In other words, not let sin rule over you. Change your attitude, Cain. Look at this in a realistic light. I'm giving you some encouragement here. Did Cain take the encouragement? No. Verse 8, Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel, and who was his brother, and he killed him. The first murder in the human life of human time of history, the very first murder. And really, we need to understand something here also, is that when the attitude is one of anger and no humility and unfairness, whose attitude is being reflected here? Satan's attitude. Satan's attitude. I think it was Mr. McNeely in a recent sermon who said, you know, I'm probably paraphrasing, but you know, all these bad things that are happening in the world, it's not just the way things are. Someone's causing it all. Someone's causing it all. Satan. He's pulling the strings. Now, we have a responsibility to look to God, but Satan knows God's not calling everyone at this point in time. And so there is a cause. This doesn't happen out of the blue. It's not, you know, there is a reason for it, just like there's a reason for sickness. You know, people take it for granted a lot. They're not taking the current virus for granted so much. But, you know, yeah, colds come along, flu comes along, you know, appendicitis comes along. This is the way it is. There's a reason for these things. And Satan is the reason when this type of attitude is reflected. Cain was not humble. He was self-willed, cocky, sort of did a halfway job about his offering, and was upset about it and said, I'll just take care of my problem. I'll do away with Abel. There, God, what do you think now? Well, God told him what he thought. Cain was then upset. When it came to rest, God said, you know, I'm going to put a mark on you. Cain was afraid people would hunt him down and kill him. He said, I'll put a mark on you. I'm going to set you aside here. You're going to live out a life that's going to be a tough life. But you didn't take my input. And I've got insight into you, Cain, and what your attitude is, but you don't understand me and you don't want to. So we have those two examples. Cain paid lip service. Sort of went along, yet he was angry and upset about the whole situation. And the only way that came about was he fell under the influence of Satan. Now let's look at two others, Abraham and Jonah. All these are interesting when we begin to really analyze the attitudes and the responses that happen when God's giving out these jobs. And there's a certain amount of stress, as we all know, in obeying God, a certain amount of hard work that goes into it, and God understands that, and he's always encouraging. But we're going to look now and compare Abraham and Jonah. So if you will, let's go over to Genesis, the 11th chapter, while we're right here. And you're probably ahead of me a little bit on some of this because you know these stories, but maybe not in the framework we're going to put them in. So in Genesis, the 11th chapter, we can start out, I think, in verse 7, maybe a little later in that chapter, but we know here that Abraham was introduced to us and that God had a job for him. And it tells us in verse 29, Abraham had a wife named Sarah and couldn't have any children. And Abraham was concerned about that and had the right attitude and the right input. God began to deal with him and work with him. And in verse 12 here, what's the first thing out of God's mouth in this particular time frame? He says, get out of your country, Abraham. Pack up and leave from your kindred, from your family, from your father's house. I'm sure Abraham probably said, well, where am I going? Well, I got a job for you. I'm going to make a great nation out of you. I'm going to send you to a land that I will show you. I was thinking about that. I thought, you know, we rent where we live. Someone knocked on my doors, that someone being the landlord, about 7 one morning and say, hey, Lander, you got to be out of here by tomorrow morning. Get it all together and let's go. I'm sure Abraham was a little bit shocked. I would be a little bit shocked. But Abraham didn't resist. We don't see any record here of him complaining. No accusation about God being unfair. None of that. He just did it. He got it all together in verse 4. And Abraham departed as the Lord had spoken to him. And Lot went with him. Abraham was 75 years old. I was probably a lot better shape than I was at 74, and certainly a lot better shape than I am now at 86. But he did it. He got up and he departed. He said, okay, that's what you want, God. I'll be ready, and we'll be leaving. So there was no fussing, no accusations of unfairness. There were some questions later on. But Abraham asked them in the right attitude. Let's go over to Genesis, the 15th chapter. And see, this was another probably, undoubtedly stressful situation for Abraham. Besides having to move on the spur of the moment, not even knowing where he was going. In chapter 15, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram. At that point in time, his name was Abram. In a vision. And God again comforts him and says, don't be afraid. I'm your shield, your exceedingly great reward. Now, Abraham asks a question. He says, well, Lord God, what will you give me, seeing I go childless? I don't even have an heir. The heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. And you know that story about Sarah couldn't bear a child. And so she said, just go into the handmaiden. And you know the story about that, and that didn't really work out very well. But Abraham was referring back to that. I don't even have a legitimate heir in my house. And behold, the Lord came to him in verse 4 of chapter 15 and said, you know, this one shall not be your heir. I know that, Abraham, but one who will come from your own body. Of course, was going to make the promise to Abram that they would have a wife, that Sarah could become pregnant even though she was beyond her years to do so. And God said to Abraham, look up. Look outside and look up. Look toward the heavens. Count the stars if you're able to number them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. This reminds me when our two oldest children were very young and we were out one very clear night. All the stars were out, and more stars than you normally see, and I had some binoculars, and we were looking, and our landlord just lived down the street from us, different time and different place in my life. And he came up behind us, and he said, Mr. Nylander, what do you see anything up there? I didn't say this, but I thought, just the universe. But it's an interesting reaction that people can have, but God took Abraham out and said, what do you see up there? What do you see up there? And Abraham looked up and said, wow, you know, I can see all the stars. And he said, count them if you can. God said, can you number them? Obviously, we can't number them. I think they say if your eyesight is really good and on a perfectly clear night, you might see somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 stars. That's about it. 2,000 and 3,000 out of multiple billions and billions. And you know, the Hubble telescope, when they sent it up, there was an area in the sky they called the coal sack, which with telescopes that existed before Hubble, it just looked like pretty much of a blank spot in the universe. And they put the Hubble on it once they got it out of the into orbit out of the Earth's atmosphere. They found 25 new galaxies up there, 25 new ones that they didn't know about and hadn't been able to see before. So no way that you and I as humans are going to number all the stars, number one, and number two. God says, I call them all by name. Can you imagine that? It's hard for me to remember, did I take my medicine last night or not? So he was making a point with Abram, or who later became Abraham, and he said, look, I'm going to make you a promise. He says, count the stars if you're able to number them. And then God said to him, so shall your descendants be. Now, Abraham didn't reply, oh, come on, God. I mean, really? That's pretty wild. Are you just putting me on? No. He believed it. In verse 6, he believed, and the Lord said, he accounted it to him as righteousness. Then he said to him, I am the Eternal who brought you out of the Ur, where he was living, of the Chaldeans, to give you this land to inherit it. And he said to God, how shall I know that I will inherit it? So he asked the question, and then God gave him some answers here about particular offerings that he was to make. And then he said, all in verse 14, he said, and also the nations whom they serve, referring up here to the people, I will judge afterwards, and they shall come out with great possessions, and talking about Israel. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried at a good old age. So this interaction between Abraham and God was very amicable. It's not wrong to ask God questions if you ask them in the right attitude and in the right tone of voice. You know, Cain didn't use the right tone of voice with God, didn't he? As I said, reading between the lines, Cain said, yeah, there's my offering, God. Hope you're happy. His attitude was wrong. Even though he obeyed God, he obeyed him in an unacceptable way. Whereas we see here in Abraham, okay, I'll move. And okay, if you say I'm going to have all this, I'll have it. If you say I'm going to have a son, good. But he did ask questions. He asked them in the right way and the right attitude. He believed God. There was no doubt. There was no hostility in that. A lot transpired. A lot went on between Abraham and God. Abraham was polite. He asked questions. No disputes. No arguing. No complaining. No accusation that God's just not fair. No reflecting of Satan's attitude. Now let's look at Jonah. And this is an interesting, these next two people we're going to look at are very interesting indeed. First of all, we'll look at Jonah, and we all know the story of Jonah, but let's just go back there and read it again in a little different light maybe than we've thought about it in the past. Going here to the book of Jonah. And we all know about Jonah. We all know the story in general, but we're going to take a closer look here. We know that God gave Jonah a job to do. You know, we see that in the very first verse of Jonah. Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, get up, go to Nineveh. Got a job for you. Go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. Jonah said, yes, sir, God, right away. Nope. Didn't say that. Jonah arose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship, and he tried to run from God, and he tried to run from the job that God gave him. Now, why did Jonah do that? Well, he knew that Nineveh was the apparently the major city, the controlling city in Assyria. And he also knew that in wars past with Nineveh, that they were a very cruel people, a people that were very harsh in their warfare. And God said, but I still want you to go down there and warn them. I've got this job. I want you to do it. It's necessary. And Jonah just tried to run from the problem. He said, nope, not going to do that. I'm just going to leave and go somewhere else. I'm in disagreement with what you want to do, God. And reading it a little bit between the lines, it's pretty obvious. Jonah was saying, I'm right, God, and you're wrong, period. I'm going to ignore it. I'm going to leave, get someone else to do the job. I'm out of here. Well, you know the story about being on the ship and the great storm that God probably brought up on the ship. And Jonah finally admitted that he was probably the cause of it, told the people on board, the crew, just to throw me overboard, told them what he had done. And God went ahead and prepared the great fish. You know, there's a lot of dispute in the so-called intelligent archaeologists, etc., that this never happened. It was impossible for someone to live in a whale. Well, it doesn't say God put Jonah in a whale. He prepared a special fish for him so that he could survive it, could survive it. So Jonah was exceedingly angry, very unhappy, and of course God then had the big great fish spit Jonah out. And he spit him out on a beach somewhere. And now Jonah's sort of grudgingly, well, not sort of, very grudgingly now, he's probably going to listen. But there's a scripture back in Exodus 33, verse 19, in this time frame, in this type of a situation, that we all need to read and take to heart. And this is a scripture that's always interested me. In Exodus 33, verse 19, let's notice something here. 33:19. God says, he's giving some instruction here, and he says, I will make all my goodness pass before you. He's talking to Moses, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before you. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. So we know that God answers prayers of people who don't know the truth and who aren't in the church. And sometimes he doesn't answer prayers of people that are in the church and know the truth. A lot of factors go into all this. But always keep that in mind. God says, I'm the one that'll determine who I have compassion on. And if Joe Jones down here, he's praying to me and the only way he knows how, and I haven't opened his mind, but I'm looking at his problem and for what he does understand and know, I'm going to answer his prayer. And he might look at someone in the church and say, you know, I understand your pain and your grief, your problem, but I'm training you for something and I've got things that you need to learn, and the only way you're going to learn them is to go ahead and endure this trial. So in this instance, your answer will come later. I remember Mr. Herbert Armstrong said he wondered, you know, when he was coming into the truth and he anointed his father and asked God to heal him, and his father died, and he said, I realized afterwards, well, he'll bring him up in the white throne judgment in the resurrection. So God didn't break his promise. He'll just heal him at a different time. So we need to always keep that in mind, that God will have compassion on whom he will, whether they're in the church or whether they're not in the church. And God looks at the big picture, and it's always a little different in each situation, and he takes all that into consideration. We don't have that ability. And so sometimes we just don't understand it, and then sometimes we can accuse God of being unfair. And he's not. You know, God doesn't make mistakes. God does not make mistakes. So after Jonah had repented, and God said, now go ahead and do the job I gave you. And was Jonah happy about it? No. And there's another element we need to take into consideration. We can obey God, but if we don't obey him in the right frame of mind, then things aren't going to work out for us. Now, he'll try and work with us, like he told Cain, look, you know, if you do okay, I'll take care of it. And sometimes we look at that and we start to fall prey to Satan's influence, to his mindset. Jonah still was not happy. You know, God allowed him out of the fish. And you know that story, God went ahead, and we can go back to Jonah. God went ahead and spared the people in Nineveh. And then what was Jonah's reaction? You know, he went out, he did what God asked him to do, but not in the right attitude. And when he found out that God saw their works in the last verse of chapter 3, God saw their works and they turned from their evil way and God relented. God took input. They gave the right input. They got insight into themselves. And God relented from the disaster that he had said he would bring upon them, and he didn't destroy Nineveh. And Jonah was real happy about that. I don't think so. Verse number 1 of chapter 4, but it displeased Jonah exceedingly. And what happened? He became angry. What happened when Satan got kicked out of heaven? He became angry. That's Satan's mindset, is to try and influence us to become angry with God. So he prayed to the Lord and said, Lord, wasn't this what I said when I was still in my country, when I was comfortable, when I didn't have to go through all this? I told you, God. And in his own way, what he's saying to God is, I was right and you were wrong. I was right. I told you that's the way it was going to be. He said, I told you that's why I ran from you. That's why I fled. Then notice this interesting turn here, at least verbally. What does Jonah say to God? For I know that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger, and abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. He is an interesting person, isn't he? Well, we could fall into this same trap sometimes in our attitude if we're not careful. Therefore now, O Lord, just kill me. Take my life from me. It's better for me to just go ahead and die. And what's God's input back? He said, is it right for you to be angry? Same thing he came up with and instructed Cain about. Are you right? You think this is right that you're angry, that you're mad? And so then you know that story. But there are kind of two different Jonahs here. In one sense, he understands God's truth. He knows who God is. But let's compare the Jonah of chapter 4 with the Jonah of chapter 2. Go back just briefly to chapter 2. And Jonah's talking about how God delivered him out of the whale, or out of the fish's belly, not the whale. And he said, you cast me into the deep in the heart of the seas, in verse 3, and your waves passed over me. And I said, I've been cast out of your sight, yet I look again toward your holy temple. I still know, God, that you have a holy temple, that you're coming back and all that. He understood a lot. And he said, I was trapped in the deeps of the sea, weeds were wrapped around me. I understand all that. And then he said, you know, the earth with its bars had closed behind me forever. And you brought me out of that, O Lord. And when my soul fainted within me, I remembered, O Lord, and my prayer went up to you. And those who regard worthless idols forsake their own mercy, but I will sacrifice to you the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay you what I vowed. Salvation is of the Lord. What's Jonah doing here? Seems to me he's trying to butter God up a little bit. He understands the truth. He understands what's going on. He also here in verse, second verse of Jonah 4, he also said, I know you're a gracious and merciful God and slow to anger. He knows all of that, he says, but has he really internalized all that? Nope. He's very, very angry. He's upset. God is unfair. It's just not the way it should have been. The opposite of Abraham. Abraham, God said, get up, move, you're going someplace tomorrow, pack it up, and let's go. Okay. And then he did have some questions, as we saw, and God answered them. And he said, all right, I understand that. So it's two different attitudes here. One reflects Satan's mentality and influence, and the other one reflects God's mentality and influence. And God isn't fooled, you know. He wasn't fooled by Jonah. He wasn't fooled by the fact that Jonah knew and understood the truth, but really disagreed with it. You can know something's right, and if you disagree with God, you're on the wrong side of the fence. I say you, all of us. And probably many of us, if not all of us, have at some point in our lives in the church gotten a little miffed with God or a little upset. And God understands that, but he will try to have some positive impact to come back to you if you keep your attitude right. But if you fall prey to this negative, angry, accusation type mindset, God's not going to come back to you in the way you want. He's going to try. He'll say, are you upset? Or think about all this and study and pray and we can work this out. But if not, you know, God's not going to force us with our attitude. He's going to work with us if we allow him to work with us. So let's go to a final example here of an individual named Balaam. Balaam is a very, very interesting person and somewhat of a puzzle. Balaam is a complicated story of events. We'll start out in Numbers. If you go back to Numbers, 22nd chapter. Numbers, the 22nd chapter. And I don't know how much this has been pointed out before. I know it's some. Usually when you think of Balaam, you think of the talking donkey. But, you know, just in a nutshell, I'm not going to go through all this because I said he's a very complicated person in a sense and a lot of details of different problems here regarding Balaam. The interesting thing about Balaam was apparently he was not an Israelite. Balaam was not an Israelite. And Balaam was a combination of corruption and also had an understanding of God's truth. He knew God. He communicated with God. He had a certain righteousness about him, but it was iron and clay. And a lot of iron and clay, or I mean a lot of clay mixed in with that iron. But in Numbers, if you're over here in the 22nd chapter, that's the one about the donkey and the problems that went on. But let's go to verse 7 of Numbers 22. Verse 7 of Numbers 22. So the elders of Moab, and you know there were always these wars and problems going on, and this king Balak, B-A-L-A-K, wanted to hire Balaam to go to God and curse Israel. Kind of a convoluted and odd story in a way, but that's the groundwork for it. And we'll start in verse 6. Therefore, he says, please come, talking to Balaam, curse this people for me, for they are too mighty for me. And perhaps then I'll be able to defeat them, because Israel had defeated several nations before, and this King Balak understood that. He said, I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and whom you curse is cursed. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed, and they had a diviner's fee in their hand. Well, what's the diviner's fee? Well, that's the money. That's an older way of explaining that you pay a fortune teller. And you go and pay a fortune teller, and then you pay them and tell me, you know, am I going to be married at the age of whatever, or am I going to get this job? So they had those types of individuals who were actually either highly influenced by demons or actually possessed. And they took this large sum of money, and they went to Balaam, and they tried to strike this deal with him, you know. You go to God, your God, we know he is behind this God of Israel, and they're just going through and defeating everyone that at that point in time that they came into contact with when war broke out. And he said, you go to that God of yours, and you get him to curse Israel, and you can have this diviner's fee. He didn't say how much it was. And Balaam wanted that money. He wanted that money. He said, this looks like a deal. Maybe I could work something out here. Well, what was Balaam doing? Balaam was trying to play both sides of the fence, wasn't he? He's trying to keep one foot with God, and he wanted to keep that other foot over here and maybe get the big payoff. He tried to walk both sides of the fence, so to speak. He wanted the money, but he also had a certain fear of God. Now, in the book of Jude, let's just take a look here in Jude. We can find it real quick. I thought I put a marker there, but I didn't. And my pages stick together, but in the book of Jude, it refers to Balaam, and it points out that actually Balaam was profit-oriented. Balaam was profitly oriented. He wanted that money. He had a greed for money and a greed for profit. And that, as I said, he's a complicated person. And yet God did interact with him. God did work with him, or try to work with him, but he, in fact, ended up having to correct Balaam as the end result, and Balaam was killed in one of the wars. He was killed by a spear, according to some of the Greek writers and philosophers. But the basic thing that we need to think about Balaam was that he was an individual that wanted to keep a foot in on each side here. He wanted to keep a foot in with God, and he had gained some reputation as knowing the God of Israel. And at the same time, he did not want to totally obey God. He wanted the money. So he was torn between obedience and between greed, which comes down to he wanted the approval of God, and he also wanted the money that he was going to get. God wouldn't listen to him. God didn't protect him in the battle, and Balaam ended up being killed. But Balaam was very much an odd person and very much a double-minded individual. You know, God has a scripture that refers to that. He says, you know, double-minded, it's in the book of James, the double-minded person cannot expect anything. You can't keep one foot in God's truth and one foot out here in the other realm that actually is influenced and ruled by Satan. No way that can be done. You know, God has given us trying times. We can ask the question here, what's all this got to do with us? What's all this got to do with us? You know? Well, someone once said, and I think it's very true, that trying times and stress defines who we are. And what we become. When we go through really strict trials, it defines what we are and who we are. It also reveals what we should be. And we know that things are getting quite weird and strange in the world that we're living in. We don't know how close, but Mr. McCain was talking and touching on that subject too. God's in control. We know that Christ is going to return. But we know there's a lot of grief and a lot of problems and a lot of trials that are coming, and we're going to be in the next few years living in the middle of it. maybe more than you than me, because I've got a few years on most of you, I don't know. I could live to be 100. I hope not. No. But at any rate, we don't know. You know, things can change overnight, as we've seen with this virus. Things can change overnight. We know that we're going to be persecuted. We know that fiery trials are coming. Let's just go to that in 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter chapter 4, and we can read here in verse 12. It says, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened. But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you for the spirit of glory. Blessed are you for the spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part, he is blasphemed, but on your part, he is glorified." We've got some tough, real tough times coming up. You know, we've had, I think I told you a long time in one of my sermons, I was bragging when I was a little kid about this toy I had to the barber, and he said, "Yeah, well, you're eating your sweetbread now." And I didn't understand that till I got older. You know, we've, in a sense, been eating our sweetbread, but we've got some really tough times coming up. We don't even know what's going to happen after this election, you know. They're talking about some of these militant groups now, maybe marching on some of the polling booths and on, we have no idea. God's in control, but he does warn us that fiery trials are coming. And, you know, overnight, persecution could start with us. And just something that maybe a politician would pick up on from the Church of God, or maybe God starts ramping up his warning more to the people. Things could change very much overnight. And make that statement again that trying times and stress defines who we really are and what kind of character we have. So we need to do some self-searching and realize we're living in very unusual times. And we will be and continue to be what we are. In other words, we're faithful to God now, as Abraham and Abel were faithful. And we need to stay that way. We need to be avoiding Satan's mindset and understanding that it's going to be easy when times get tough. So it's going to be easy to say, "Well, I don't think this is exactly fair, is it, God? Maybe I'm having second thoughts about all this." Remember what God and what Christ said? He said when the false religious leader arises, said he would even fool the elect if it were so. So there's going to be some stress coming up. And we're going to have to not listen and become and inherit, or not inherit, but take in to internalize some of the attitudes that we saw in the people in this sermon who opposed God. We're going to be careful. We have to be careful of not becoming Cain, not becoming Jonah, not becoming Balaam, you know, not being angry with God because we're suffering, not being upset with him, not being double-minded, not being trying to play both sides of the fence, and maybe I can please God, but not, maybe I can avoid a lot of this persecution by going along with this. So we have to avoid all that. You know, we have to avoid all that. It's going to get very tough and very sticky, and I don't know. 5 years, 10 years, tomorrow, who does know? Let's go back to the book of Revelation in chapter 12 and keep something in mind as all this is transpiring before us, talking about, you know, the tribulation and the difficult times that are coming, and talking about in verse 10, those of us who are called and who are obeying and who are trying to do our best to do the work. Verse 10 of Revelation 12 says, "Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of Christ have come, for the accuser of our brethren, he accuses them before our God day and night, has been cast down. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. And they did not love their lives to death. Therefore rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil has come down to you kind of upset. Nope. It says, for the devil has come down to you having great wrath, because he knows he has a short time. A great wrath. You know, remember what Christ told us. They hated me, they're going to hate you. We have some difficult times coming. We need to guard against thinking God's unfair. We need to guard against obeying God grudgingly. We need to understand where we are in time and that God eventually will solve all this mess. Christ says, be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. And for you and I, it's a matter of eternal life or eternal death. Eternal life or eternal death. And so let's keep all these things in mind. You know, in 1 Corinthians 10, you can just write that down, 11 through 13, it states all these things happen. All these things happen for us for a reason. You know, we are being trained, and I think this was pointed out in one of the sermons I was able to monitor during the feast on my iPad. We're being trained to be part of the royal family. We're the first fruits. We're going to have the highest positions. So we're going to go through the tougher times. We're going to go through the tougher times and things that are much more difficult. And when Satan comes down with great wrath, it's going to get pretty difficult. We're going to be going, if it happens in our lifetimes, we're going to be going through a lot of stress, and that's going to determine what we are, whether we're going to be part of that royal family of God, the first fruits, or whether we're going to fall prey to Satan's mindset of accusing God, of trying to be double-minded, of trying to play both sides of the fence, of trying to hem-haw around and make God happy and at the same time do some of the things that the false religious leader is going to be forcing on people in a religious sense. So let's keep all these things in mind and keep an eye on what's going on in the world. As Christ always said, watch. And oftentimes when that scripture is listed in the Bible, the word watch can also be translated watch out or wake up. And we need to take very careful assessment of what's going on in the world, stick close to God, and not fall into the traps that Satan would lay for us out there about souring our attitude about our calling and about what God's preparing us for.